We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. I actually was going to modify the intro today. That's why you may have heard slight hesitation, because what I wanted to say was, we're back against my better judgment with another edition of Federalist Radio Hour featuring Rachel Bovard, policy director at the Conservative Partnership Institute, and Inez Stepman of the Independent Women's Forum. Welcome back to both of you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here against a better judgment.
Yeah, you should listen to your judgment. Always listen to your gut, heart. Emily.
Yeah. Well, so this is, we refer to these as a public gathering of the group chat, because it's that time once a month where we take our signal chat onto the podcast, because there are a lot of frustrations bubbling on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. This time, however, there is perhaps a note of optimism to be sounded when it comes to Twitter and Elon Musk and Disney and Ron DeSantis. One of the articles Inez just sent our way is a Wall Street Journal piece about how Ron DeSantis is basically, or how Republicans are basically saying that if they win back the House and the Senate, these sort of CEOs of woke corporations should expect to endure hours and hours of congressional testimony. And actually, this is something I want to throw to both of you. You're both actually sort of well positioned to discuss this. Inez, I'll start with you, because you were so heartened by this news. Why do you see this as sort of a fundamentally, or a sign that this is headed in the right direction?
Yeah, I guess really Rachel would be the best person to ask about this, because she knows so much more about the specifics than I do. But just from a 10,000 foot perspective, I think this is less about what they're afraid Republicans might do in Congress and more about watching Ron DeSantis nail a big fat scalp to the wall in Florida. And my thoughts were two things, really. One, this is really encouraging. It makes me smile to think of these meetings, frantic meetings taking place all over corporate America. What do we do? What do we do? That's exactly what needs to happen. And the second point I wanted to make is kind of related, which is, woke capital is probably one of the strongest tools, arguably the strongest tool the left has in terms of institutional takeover. It's been an enormous sort of sledgehammer for them. But it's also one of their wobbliest, right? By its nature, by their nature, corporations, they're not true believers the way that, K-12 or higher academia is, right, or are. They really, they can be scared into neutrality again by a show of political force, really of using political power and to hit back at them in the way that they're using political power, right? They are conducting themselves as political players for one side. And until now, they could do that without worrying that the other side would treat them as what they are, which is political players. So I think they're actually some of the easiest to sort of, quote unquote, scare straight, right? Because at least until, and here's my note of pessimism and the optimism, at least until a few more years of graduates, fill in those ranks, right? Right now they're being run, the C-suite decisions are mostly being made by Gen X, maybe some elder millennials, right? But once you have sort of that generational turnover that we always talk about, it'll be much, much harder to deal with this problem in the same way that it's much, much harder to deal with it in academia or in some of these other institutions where the left has had a stranglehold for far longer. So that's just sort of a double down. Like, this needs to happen now. It needs to happen now where these kinds of political threats actually still have some kind of efficacy and actually can... Because I actually don't think we're going to have to make that many of them before before you start to see companies really have these meetings and take notice and start to think that maybe coming out swinging for leftist cultural issues actually has consequences for them in a way that it hasn't until now.
Yeah. And if those consequences are being hauled before Congress for public testimony, remember that a lot of what they're scared about here is public relations. And so then that has to factor into their calculation if this is being dragged into the news cycle day after day after day. So, Rachel, then the question for you is, what sort of lines of inquiry do you think would be sort of substantive and legitimate for a Republican House and Senate to push on woke CEOs? Obviously, it's not illegal to be a woke CEO, but there are obviously particular ways to get at that question if you're a Republican committee chair.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting because I'm slightly cynical at this point about the notion of congressional hearings. I think having watched years and years of them with the tech executives to no end whatsoever. And I think it's really important to highlight what Ron DeSantis did because it draws a very clear line of demarcation between the hot rhetoric of committee hearings and actually just doing the thing.
Right.
Right. And to Inez's point, nailing a scalp to the wall and saying, look at it, right? This is what will happen to you, and being very clear. And that's why, like, I don't even think, you know, you have endless layers of this debate about, well, is what Florida did going to be struck down in court? You know, what legal options? It almost doesn't even matter because it was done. Right. And now Disney has to deal with that fallout of, you know, not only it happening, but then having to fight it in court. Like, no company actually wants to deal with it. And the problem with congressional hearings, and I'm not writing them off completely, like, I actually think they can be useful. And I think it's interesting, you know, what has gone on with the January 6th Select Committee has laid down a series of remarkable precedents for what a congressional committee can actually do, it wildly unprecedented in terms of what they can ask for, right, if Republicans choose to use that. But, you know, it's to the point now where I think CEOs are so used to the idea that Congress might ask them questions that entire consultancies exist to prep them for this. And the way they prep these CEOs is, here's how to say nothing, right? And likewise, you have these members of Congress who, yeah, you know, some of them I think actually do want answers and details about what went on, but in many cases, they want to bang on the dais, they want a YouTube moment, and that's the end of it. So it's almost like a very performative process for both sides that I think, you know, has some utility, but at the end of the day, what DeSantis did was he didn't talk about it. He just freaking, the legislature also did it. Right. And that's the other thing that sort of annoyed me about this debate, by the way. Everyone's like, oh, Ron DeSantis. No, this wasn't executive action. This was a self-government. This was a elected legislature taking a stand, which is much, much different. Right. You can't say that this was like the tyranny of Ron DeSantis. No, like the people's representatives passed this bill. And to Inez's point, it was simply like Disney doesn't just get to act like a political actor without, you know, the people's representatives saying, yeah, okay, fine, you're going to be in politics, we're going to yank your sweetheart tax deal. Like, that's a sort of the, you know, Newtonian physics of politics, right? An equal and opposite reaction. Like, and that's what we're living in right now. And I think it's for the better.
That was, I do want to throw out, can I just throw out one thing? Ron DeSantis directly, Rachel, you're right to make a sort of legal distinction. And obviously it's very important for self-government purposes that this went through the legislature and not through gubernatorial edict. But it also gives me hope for a different reason, which is the Republicans in Florida never in a thousand years would have done this without like really strong leadership from Ron DeSantis, right? Because they have all the same problems that Republicans everywhere have. You know, there are lobbyists. I'm sure that Disney had a lot of lobbyists going to a lot of quote unquote pro-business Republicans and complaining about this, right? So it does show that you can actually shape even a very reluctant party. And it gives me, and I'm not like, you know, I'm not being paid to pump Ron DeSantis here or whatever. I have no like sort of personal stake in this, but it does give one hope that actually even as sorry shape as the Republican Party is in, especially on the federal level, that if you do have somebody who is really clear about an agenda, that understands to quote Dave Riboy as always, what time it is, if you have a really good leader who can do that, you can essentially, you don't need to make true believers, same way in terms of the companies and their like sort of woke commitments. You don't need to make true believers on the right out of your Republican representatives. All you need to do is lay out an important and popular agenda and then, you know, sort of wield political power and make it clear that in fact you're going to make it difficult for them to get reelected if they don't fall in line with this more strategic and important agenda. So again, that's kind of hopeful because there's no way there's going to be sort of a mass come to Jesus moment on the Republican Party, but one can imagine somebody with a really strong agenda getting elected and essentially whipping the party into shape, which is what's happening in Florida.
Rachel Stock is a staunch libertarian that is sort of barking in opposition as the authoritarian wing of the Republican Party, or the conservative movement, I should say. Barks.
The FedEx truck is her nemesis. She's really opposed to
big business. See,
yeah, she's really opposed to big business.
So the central question to me actually seems to be sort of an abstract one, and Inez sort of hit at it earlier, which is, remember how all of this started with Disney? Is that the CEO said the company, he did not want the company to become a political football. And that in and of itself is what sparked the backlash. So the concept of neutrality was what the Disney embracing neutrality was, not even embracing the right or conservatism, but embracing neutrality was enough to set off alarms that convinced the CEO they had to get aggressively involved in this fight in the ways that they did going forward. And this is something that Jack Dorsey actually, when he was, I think he may have said this in front of Congress or it was an interview either way, he said that neutrality is no longer an option for us when it comes to speech moderation back in 2019, because the far left activist wing of the progressive movement was saying that, you know, silence is violence, neutrality is complicity. And when you implant that in enough young minds, enough millennial minds, it's so powerful because it can bulldoze, you know, boomer Xer CEOs into action, because the alternative is serious charges of violence and complicity that the media will take and run with, and that social media will take and run with. So that said, the question then becomes, can CEOs, if they start facing serious threats to their bottom lines, and it's not a major threat to Disney, but you know, substantial threats to their bottom lines from politicians like Ron DeSantis or whomever else, is that enough in this sort of race against the clock dynamic? Of course, I think we can all agree it is the minimum, the bare minimum, but is even that enough to sort of staunch this problem?
I kind of think it depends on the line of business, right? Like, there's so many subjective factors here. I think with Disney, you know, it's not just the bottom line, it's the fact that their entire branding is to be like in your home, right? And to be, you know, an educational aid and to be like a friend to your kid. And so the minute you sow distrust, the minute parents start to see that you have an agenda to manipulate their kids, which is, I think, you know, what is going on here with Disney, and all the leaked video from Chris Rufo shows this in spades, you know, then I think you have a business model problem. And, you know, what's interesting is I recently finished the book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital by Stephen Sokup, I probably butchered his last name, but, you know, and it's very interesting to read, because you see the intentionality with which the left has gone to these CEOs and to these businesses and to say that this is your moral imperative and there will never be consequence for you because you were on the right side of history, right? So for the Republicans, you know, and the right more broadly, culturally, to change that calculus, I do think kind of throws them off a little bit. But as much as something like this may work for Disney, I don't know that it will work for some company like a Vanguard, right? Or a BlackRock, who is, you know, these passive asset managers who don't necessarily, you know, they're removed, you know, their clientele is sort of Wall Street and business. If they don't have the direct consumer access, and yet they are driving so many of the positions of these companies. So, but I do think at the end of the day, though, these CEOs, to go back to Inez's original point, these CEOs have been put on notice that you can't simply act in a political way without receiving a political response. And that's the critical distinction here with Disney. No one's saying to Disney, you can't speak and you can't be active and you can have political opinions. You can. It's just that now people will respond. Legislators will respond by yanking your sweetheart tax deal. Like, again, it's this Newtonian physics, right, that didn't exist before, this pendulum effect, you know, that now exists in politics that didn't. And that, it's been a long time coming for the right, you know, and I think it's a question of whether we can maintain it, to be honest.
Hey! COVID broke the economy, and now a recession may be coming. A Federal Reserve survey broke some bad news, dating back to the 50s whenever inflation and unemployment have hit today's levels. History suggests a recession may be near. Remember what the last recession did to your retirement? It's so hard to forget. It seems like all of the time on this show, we're looking back at the aftermath of 08. So our friends at Lear Capital shared how investing in physical gold and precious metals can be a brilliant strategy against what's coming. Smart investors are buying gold and precious metals now for two reasons. One, gold can be a great hedge during a recession. And two, the closer a recession gets, the more your gold could be worth. Don't let your retirement take a hit like 08. Talk with the team at Lear Capital about owning precious metals for your savings and retirement accounts. Right now, you'll receive up to $10,000 in free bonus coins based on the value of gold coins you purchase. Visit LearFederalist.com. That's LearFederalist.com. LearFederalist.com.
So there's a really good essay by Daryl E. Paul and Wesley Yang Substack about this, and it goes through a series of sort of it goes through the book you mentioned as Rachel, as well as Vivek Ramaswamy's work, a few others, and basically comes to the conclusion that like this is coming from a number of different directions. You have to have a more integrated understanding of it. It's definitely coming from the top in terms of ESG. It's definitely coming from the bottom in terms of woke graduates. And he ultimately falls down on the side of saying the most important element here is this credentialing system, is the graduates coming in. And I agree with that assessment, but that doesn't mean that the other things aren't true as well. It's this very so I think an answer to your question, Emily, originally is it's going to depend on the company and it's going to depend on what time. Right. So like I really do think the solutions at this point only become more radical. Right. And the earlier that we intervene in this process in a substantive way and a substantial way, I was trying to combine those two words. but the earlier we do it, the less radical the solution has to be. Right.
The order is substantiative. Yeah. Substantiative.
Right. What was it? Sarah Palin had one of these neologisms during the 2008 election. Anyway, but yeah, the earlier we do it, the more likely it is that we can do the scalp on the wall point at it, you know, just by pulling a sweetheart tax deal, right? That honestly, one of the funnier things about this has been libertarians saying like, this is exactly what I wanted you to do, but you did it for the wrong reasons and therefore it is tyranny, right? Similarly, like with universities, right? The earlier we do it, the earlier we cap student loans, for example, we cap federal backing of student loans, the less we're going to have to do, right? The more we
cap them, eliminate them.
Right. Well, you can't even get Republicans to cap it. That's what I'm saying. We're so far behind. But the more we punish them sort of in these theoretically ways that libertarians should really be able to get behind, right? Because there are so many government handouts and sweetheart deals to a lot of these corporations, to universities, to all of these sort of woke institutions, that the earlier you do it, you can do it in sort of a small L liberal way. You can just restore the neutrality and take away some of the perks these institutions have. But if you wait for it to go too long and you let too many sort of indoctrinated graduates rise in the ranks of all of these institutions, that's not going to be enough. And you are going to be stuck in sort of a Spanish Civil War type, you know, escalating situation where the only solutions become illiberal. And I don't want to live in that. I don't want to live in that world.
But you already do, according to David French.
Yeah, well.
Well, but that's my frustration with this, too, because it's, again, like so much of this, it's not, well, you're targeting business. No, we've favored individual and select businesses in so many ways. And I mean, they're littered at the state level, but even at the federal level, right? I mean, we have carve outs for these businesses constantly. And so to simply say, I'm going to remove what privilege that you were granted is not punishing a company. It's literally putting them on a playing field equal to everybody else. And I've said this for a couple of years now, it's like the rights agenda doesn't need to be like targeting business. It just simply needs to be deprioritizing what we've always prioritized, which is like major, you know, handouts to these businesses. They can go beg Elizabeth Warren for the bailout. I'm not that. See what happens.
Here's the ultimate test. There was a story a couple of weeks ago. I forget the specifics. It was either someone at like Raytheon or Lockheed. They had like toned down their Pride Month celebration, and this was upsetting to the employees to the point where their opposition to this made it into the press. Do Republicans and carve outs for woke defense contractors?
That's like. We know we'll have made it to Mount Olympus if we actually like cut off Raytheon.
Okay, so I don't want to go out of order here, but I had a thought that I wanted to get Rachel's opinion on. And Inez, you might know something about this too. There's sort of famous polling that shows people's approval of Congress as a whole is generally way more negative than their approval of their specific member of Congress. And I wonder if that's at play in the incentives for Republicans to take away a chunk of funding for education, and that like people are sort of exhausted by higher ed and they think all of this stuff is nuts. But you know, if you talk about defunding Ohio State or the University of Wisconsin, people are a lot more people in state. If Ron Johnson hypothetically had to, you know, face that attack from his opponent, that would be a lot more damaging. Do you feel like that's a part of this incentive calculation for Republican politicians still?
You know, I think that's a really interesting point that I hadn't considered, and it makes total sense. Like, I think when people talk about like woke universities and defunding the universities, they're obviously not thinking about where they went to school, mm-hmm. right? They're not thinking about their state university. They're thinking about Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, you know, where they think the elites are formed. But it's also kind of this interesting feature too, because, you know, I have a friend who is always works at a nonprofit, and he's always trying to get the interns there to drop out of college and just like go into the workforce. And I'm like, would you want that for, you know, okay, fine. But right. Would you do that for your own kids? And right. He's like, no. Right. So there is this sort of like divorced mentality that I do think, you know, and especially in to your point, like state schools, I think have so much of a drama around them, right? There's such gathering points and like, you know, features for like local communities that maybe, you know, that does play a role. I don't know if Inez, have you looked into this? Or have thoughts about it?
Yeah, I mean, I have seen that happen, and you're right, Emily. It's really powerful. Every either federal congressman or on the state level, every state rep who has a university in their district, one, those districts are big employers, right? Or those universities are big employers in the district. And two, there is this like sort of, in my view, again, generational disconnect. Like Ohio State in 2022, I guarantee you, is like a lot woker than Ohio State 20 years ago when attended university. And there is a disconnect. And they even now don't fully understand, although I think that's changing. I mean, if you look at polls,
yeah,
there's just been a plummeting trust in universities to the point where even pre-pandemic, right, in 2018, 2019, you had universities go underwater on the question, not just general public trust, like every other institution, but on the specific question, do you think universities are a net positive for the United States? Which is a really basic question, right? If anything, that should skew towards the other team here. And you now have less than 50% of people, even in 2019, saying that universities are a net positive for the United States, right? So that is driven by a huge drop off from Republicans and independents. Oh, well, Democrats still support universities for obvious reasons.
That's a really good point. And it makes me think a policy way to do it might be coupling an agreement on caps with an agreement on the part of the universities. If they want to just have caps instead of whatever, it gives them an excuse to cut funding in certain areas. You know, you cut X amount of red tape, you rein in this department or that department, which again, this all sounds impossible, but in this new climate that you just sort of highlighted, Inez, I think there might be Republicans should be seriously thinking about all of this. I'm not sure they are.
Well, I mean, on universities, there's just a long litany. Unlike with K-12 on the federal level, there's really not that much that can be done on K-12 on the federal level that really is in the hands of states. You know, overwhelmingly, still the funding comes from states and localities. In any case, it's not always a good idea, even in positive reforms. Like, for example, I really strongly oppose the idea the Trump administration had about the federal tax credit, like essentially federal school choice. Even though I'm very pro school choice, because a federal tax credit is subject to bureaucratic regulation, right? So the Department of Education can put out a regulation.
Dear colleague.
Now, a dear colleague letter on Title IX and force all private schools that have somebody attending on that kind of scholarship into compliance with a bunch of woke stuff. So I think on K-12, it's really just a lot of sound and fury, signifying nothing. There's not a lot that the feds can do. But on higher ed, the opposite is true. The federal government is the lifeblood of virtually every university in this country. And they are that way directly through grants, all kinds of grants for various research projects, and then state government money going to public universities. And then the most important piece of that puzzle is $1.7 trillion in outstanding student loan debt, 93% of which is now completely financed through the federal government, right? Mm-hmm. So a large percentage of the universities in America could not exist without the federal loan program. Their degrees are not sort of marketable on the open market. And here I do want to again inject a note of cynicism by saying you get a lot of pushback still from not just from idiotic Republican elected officials, but from people themselves saying like, let's let the studies majors, you know, the queer studies majors sink or swim, you know, they're all baristas and they want forgiveness on their student loans.
No, they're running HR departments.
No, exactly. Yeah, this is a six-figure job in ideological compliance. You're completely wrong.
They're working in academia.
Really lucrative.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so, they're not making your soy latte. They're like trying to get you fired.
Now, granted, there are way too many people working as baristas who are overeducated.
It's not a matter of it. I always get that pushback. Like, let's just forgive debt, for example, for STEM degrees. And first of all, there's a lot of both anecdotal and at this point, some survey evidence that STEM degree fields are just as woke increasingly as the humanities. That was maybe a distinction that was true 10 years ago, is no longer. And second of all, like this idea of like, oh yeah, like just let, it's fine. You know, these graduates, if we take away this benefit, these graduates are going to fail. No, not really. But it's still really, really helpful to pull a lot of these benefits to the point we were talking about with Disney, like to reduce colleges really do have way more than any corporation in America. Universities have this very special subsidized status, right? Where the taxpayer is directly funding them and directly giving loans that banks would not give, right? So it really is a situation where not only if we withdrew some of this money, it would be an enormous hit on, like, let's say 80% of universities in America, or even 90%. And two, start slapping strings on that money, right? I would love to see an inquisition out of the next Republican Department of Education on noncompliance with civil rights law. A lot of this stuff, these separate affinity groups, all of the for example, the soft affirmative action that is practiced in virtually every university in America, and then the discrimination correspondingly against Asian applicants, right? So, like, I would like to see some inquisitions coming out of the because universities, again, unlike K-12, universities, there's 1,000 different levers to push to make their lives miserable. And that's what I think really needs to be done, right? We have the example of Disney. We need to make a couple examples in the universities. We need to, like, you know, put some scalps, their scalps on the wall and point to all the other universities and say, your entire lifeblood comes from the federal government. You need to start complying as a very basic start. You need to start complying with federal civil rights law in a way that's actually meaningful. And you need to you need to respect free speech.
I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and a available in a variety of colors. Each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set regularly $109.99 for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza Dream Sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Well, right. That's what I haven't understood. The civil rights string being attached seems the most obvious. And I wonder if part of this is because people don't realize outside of maybe conservative Twitter how these trainings are like flat out openly racist and sexist or whatever. They violate all of these different obvious, I think, consensus definitions of bigotry. And that seems like the most are you telling me Disney has nothing in their HR trainings or their compliance trainings that embraces these ideas that might be completely non-compliant with the Civil Rights Act of 1964? I highly doubt it. I'm sure they are doing something like that. And so just that string, it seems like such an obvious one to be highlighting.
Well, it's one that's been used against us for the last 30, 40 years. And a lot of this compliance bureaucracy, especially in there is a large piece of the woke capital question. I mean, I still think the graduates piece is the most important, but like there is a large part of this puzzle that is especially the additions and revisements to civil rights law that were done in the 90s that changed, for example, the amount you can collect if you can sue for a hostile workplace environment, right? So the employment law strings that are part of our federal civil rights law, which were intended, to try to provide a way to sue for people who lost out on a job because they weren't hired because of their race. First of all, even that might be happening to Asian and white applicants at this point. But second of all, it created, especially in the sexual harassment context, it created this enormous incentive for kind of CYA companies to push out, quote unquote, anything that could be considered offensive speech in the workplace, because it allowed plaintiffs to pick and choose, all of like, basically it no longer had to be sustained from a particular person or endorsed by the company. It could be piecemeal. Like this employee made a joke that a woman found offensive. This employee has a picture of a woman in a bikini on his desk. Like this employer has blah, 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 right? Or this employee has blah, blah, blah. All of that adds up together to a big financial payout. And so companies had an incentive to start hiring these diversity trainers and starting those really lame sexual harassment videos that everyone laughs at from the 90s, right? But that's when a lot of this started. And then it slotted very easily into the whole microaggression stuff and the combination of this massive civil rights apparatus, especially post 90s, slotted perfectly with the advancement of the ideology that was then coming out with the younger employees.
And Rachel, I want to toss this to you with the Musk question, because one thing that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks is how it does feel as though new routes to push back on intellectual capture with sort of intellectual capture rebuttal Elon Musk could capture the institution of Twitter. We see different ways of doing this, but there's, again, this is what we were talking about earlier, the note of optimism. The Republican National Committee decided not to comply or not to cooperate with a formal presidential debate commission a few weeks ago, which I thought was long overdue. I mean, they should have done that 10 years ago. That's part of the problem with the media right now, is that the pushback wasn't strong enough 10, 20 years ago. But they did it. They voted and they did it, and it's happening, which is fantastic. And then Elon Musk actually buys Twitter, unless that stopped for some crazy reason going forward, which is an impossible. And Disney gets so much pushback. This bill passes in Florida. Whether or not you think it's good or bad policy, it shows there's a huge difference in the Republican Party for the better at this point. So going forward, is there, especially with Twitter, is Twitter an example of this, or is that still like very much yet to be seen?
I mean, it is in the sense that, like, you can say, well, it can be done. Although I would argue that, like, yeah, if we can all just become the richest man in the world, we could save a lot of institutions, right? So this is kind of a one-off. And to your point, I don't know that he will be allowed to succeed. I think he's saying a lot of the right things. I think he is, you know, considering a lot of the right things. But if he doesn't go in there and clean house, like, he is going to be kind of attacked from within. And I think by the employees, and not allowed to succeed. Because, you know, as sort of the theme that we keep coming back to, it's not just the people at the top, it's the employees, right? It's the woke college graduates that get in there that dictate how these things are run. So I think, you know, the right has an institutional problem in that regard. But, you know, it is interesting in the sense also, I would point to as an example, the Tucker Carlson hit piece that
I
came
was
out.
Just going to ask about this.
Yeah, okay, it was yesterday's New York Times, I think. And it was like this 7-page spread, basically making, you know, Tucker Carlson's a racist, just like over and over and over again. And 10 years ago, that would have ruined your life, ruined your career. Like, you would have had to change your name and like move overseas. And now it's like, no one, everyone just ignores it, right? Well, you know, on the right, I think everybody who watches Tucker Carlson is like, yeah, okay, predictably, because they know the New York Times has evolved into an organ that literally just prints, you know, confirmation bias for liberals and, you know, doesn't at all talk about the fact that Tucker Carlson actually has a significant Democratic audience. I think he beats Rachel Maddow in that time slot for Democratic viewers, right? It doesn't talk at all about those nuances. And so you, I think you are seeing a shift where people just, you know, to the extent that the people who, Democrats who control the cultural levers of power have become so overt about punching people who disagree with them in the face repeatedly, that eventually those people are either going to stop listening or they're going to punch back. And that's, we're in this phase, I think, of where the right's finally waking up to it. But, you know, I don't know. I think I'm always slightly cynical about these questions. So I don't know if it's like a trend that's going to continue, because so much of what's happening right now involve remarkable figures. Like, there's not Elon Musk's, there is no plural of Elon Musk, right? There's, you know, altruistic billionaires don't just come out of the, grow out of the ground. Like, it's not like we can
there's Peter Thiel.
Yeah, there's Peter Thiel, but, you know, TBD, right?
Right.
There's not a lot of people is what I'm saying. Tucker Carlson is only one person. He's too big to fail in some respects. Like, not everybody is like that.
Right.
So,
well, so then
I don't know if these are leading indicators.
So this, I think, is almost this brings us to a two pronged sort of not strategy, but outlook for the future. One is, are the incentives naturally evolving to a place where the CEO of Disney and Elon Musk sort of have the same business understanding of the demand for neutrality? And I do think that's behind why Elon Musk sees Twitter as a shiny object. Yes, I think it's sincere, but I also think he recognizes that there's a potential to turn this company around because there's a market. Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, this is my big question mark, because I think the point, and as raised earlier, you sort of raised it and drove past it, but I think it's so profound in this context, is that this is so generational. Because in many cases, you have Gen Xers who are comfortable in this idea of neutrality. They kind of grew up with it. It makes sense to them. You know, they aren't necessarily towering figures of moral principle, so they were willing to get bullied by their employees in one direction, but now they're willing to come back the other way. Millennials are a total generation of cry bullies. That is what we are, and that's what we're raised to be. The Zoomers are worse. The Zoomers are just like straight up ideological stormtroopers. And if this is who we have coming through the pipeline, I don't know that you maintain, right? Like, you almost have to create an economy that forces people into some kind of neutrality, which is just different than what we have now.
I'm just sort of split on the Zoomers, and because this is a generation that has sort of been saturated with the clang of different podcasts and Instagram accounts, and I understand that a lot of them are very radical on these ideas because they're totally post-truth in a way that prior generations aren't necessarily. That said, I do think like the Joe Rogan, Dave Chappelle discourse has absolutely penetrated that generation in a formative way. I think the same for the kind of Abigail Schreier. I mean, this is happening in every school and every community. And before they're out of college, most of them will know somebody who was really harmed by this concept of trans ideology, radical trans ideology. So I'm actually like, I'm not saying I'm optimistic, but I do wonder if they feel so sort of lied to by elites. They're very distrustful of the Democratic establishment. They're very distrustful of sort of the corporate establishment. So where that goes going forward, I don't know. I don't think you're wrong, Rachel, that there's a big chunk of them that are post-truth radicals in a terrifying way.
Well, you are closer to the Zoomers than me. And an
that's true. That's true. I just bought some flares the other day.
I don't even know what that is.
Whatever, Emily. Jeans? I've been wearing flares for a while.
Flare jeans.
Yeah, but that's because you're in the 70s, actually, mentally still. That's how old you are.
that's right. I do think that to circle this back from the generational component, which is a real one, and frankly, my addition to that conversation would be to recall that there's always sort of a contrarian bias. I think the people in Gen Z who are rebelling against some of this stuff, I mean, they make us all look like milquetoast lefties, right? So I think that part of it is true, but it's easy to forget, because I often hear, and this is an argument that I hear a lot from libertarians, and it always is a certain type of person who makes it. I'm like, you are the contrarian that you're talking about, right? They're like, oh, kids don't actually learn anything in school. I didn't pay any attention to my teachers. You know, I formed my own opinions. In fact, if my teachers were jamming it down my throat, it wasn't cool. Yeah, that's you. That's a small percentage. If you look at surveys, it's actually not difficult. It's hard to teach, like, you know, hundreds of years of American history in detail. It is not hard to impart the general belief that America is like an irredeemably racist country from its inception. That's a really simple concept. And in some cases, like, the ideology is actually repeating the ideology is the refuge for people who are thoroughly mediocre, right, academically. So I tend to think that that's not true, actually, that the Gen Z generally is going to have more of these underlying assumptions, more embedded in their very worldview, even than millennials. So I'm not particularly optimistic on that score unless we change the pipeline from below.
I think the anti-Americanism part of this is that's the one that concerns me the most, because it's not taught as sort of like politicized or propaganda in the way that adults see it. If you're a child and you get an assignment from the 1619 agenda or curriculum, that's a very, you're not like, oh, I've heard about this on Rogan or whatever. I mean, you're five. And that keeps going until you're 18. And that is fundamentally the most terrifying thing to me. On some of these other questions, transgenderism, political correctness, free speech, all of that, I think they might be more mixed. But this, again, this is sort of where I see the two-pronged question here is one, can the incentives, shifting to the point where, you know, you have this, the neutrality again becomes the best business model, whether you're Elon Musk or Disney CEO. And then two, even if that happens, can the institutions be restored substantially to, I guess, save the future of the country, protect the future of the country from anti-Americanism, from whatever else, given that we have already, and there's no immediate solution to academia other than putting, you know, PragerU videos out and having a homeschooling revolution sort of caused by COVID, none of that is fundamentally getting at the problems with these institutions. So if the incentives shift, great, but is that enough then for the incentives to directionally, fundamentally be even at the most minimal amount they would need to be restored to? Is there time, and is it enough?
Well, okay, here's what I would say. Not without sustained, and this is Rachel's favorite word, kinetic action, right? not on its own.
I love that word.
Right? Not on its own. If we do not fundamentally act in a like serious, strategic, institutional way, very, very soon, as in now, and I'm still worried about, you know, if we don't close the pipeline on the other end and we keep producing these folks, we are, like I've said a few times that I think on this pod, like, we already have a generation and a half of people who this is going to be the fundamental way they see the world. Mm-hmm. And they're going to, you know, move through the system and get higher and higher. But that's going to look different in terms of whether the institutions can be saved or reformed, or whether we need to start from scratch. I think that's actually a really prudential question. And it depends on the sort of facts on the ground. So like academia, like higher ed, I think cannot be reformed, right? I think we are going to have to fundamentally break this credentialing cycle. Yes. And we're going to have to find an alternative to it. And I don't really believe anymore in the model of like getting a foothold in the universities by funding, you know, sort of departments. I mean, we saw how that worked out for Ilya Shapiro, right, at Georgetown.
So dumb.
It's not to say that I don't, you know, sort of think those are good ideas, but that's not going to fundamentally transform. We've been complaining about higher ed for 70 years. It's time to recognize that academia can't be saved and we have to completely reroute around it. But in other contexts, I think we still do have time, right? And I think woke capital is probably one of those cases, which Elon Musk has a power that via Twitter and Twitter employees, don't forget that Donald Trump never had, not for one second, in the federal government. That is, he can fire people.
Yeah. Well, he has to be willing to do that.
Right.
And that's the big question.
He has to
do
it, but he has the power to do it. Whereas in the federal bureaucracy, as we talked about a bunch of times, right, you can't fire career people. The entire bureaucracy fights back against you and you have no carrot and no stick to control it. That is the quote unquote deep state, right? In woke capital, there's less of that. There are still sort of free labor laws. Like Elon Musk doesn't need to fire everyone at Twitter. He just needs to fire enough people to scare people into thinking, well, just like every other canceled person on the right, do I keep my job and shut up and like do my job the way my boss wants me to do it? Or, you know, do I find a new profession? Right.
Yeah.
And that's enough to convince most people on either side.
I will say too, I think there is a note of optimism when I was listening, you know, that I forgot to mention earlier. You have companies like Coinbase, you have companies, and there's this, the software development company, I'm blanking on their name, but they went through this, like, I think it was late or early last year.
Yeah.
Where basically they were like, we aren't doing politics, right? Like we aren't having sort of a victimology narrative at work, right? Like employees can do whatever they want outside of work. They can think whatever they want outside of work, but here we do the work that we are assigned to do and that's it. And in the case of Coinbase, I think in particular, they made severance packages available, right? To people who said, that's not, I can't work in such a horrendous environment where I can't do politics. They were like, fine, you can leave. Here's your severance package. And I think like a quarter of the employees quit or something like that. But that, if that model catches on, I think that is something hopeful, right? And it kind of goes back to that Tucker Carlson example of you have to get to the point where you just stop caring what these people think anymore. And, you know, you say, this is like, I didn't hire you. I'm not paying you to have struggle sessions at work. I'm paying you to do the work that we need to do to be profitable. This is, you know, to be very clear about it. This is what it means. If it's not work for you, here, you know, here's a severance package, go find another job. I think once you start to see that, then as a point, you can actually fire people who don't agree with you, you know, that this is how we're going to conduct ourselves. You know, you have some hope of salvaging, I think, some of these bigger companies, but that takes a level of courage.
Well,
Well, to your point, it takes courage and it takes the institutional structure, in this case, you know, ordinary at will employment to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I actually am somewhat encouraged by all of this in the woke capital sphere, because I really do think, just like the majority of Americans who now self-censor, right, their political views, you know, that can go sort of the same incentive in terms of which is much more legitimate than running to the left, because we're not asking people to censor themselves like in conversations with their friends, but we're asking them not to use that corporate power, right, in that political way. I think that's salvageable. I really do think if you get enough people, you only need a few people to make a few examples before the ship starts to turn. It's much, much harder to turn the ship when you don't have those leverage points. And that's always my point with like K-12 education as well. The way that K-12 education is institutionally set up, there are no leverage points right now. Without broad-based school choice, there are no leverage points. The people who you're arguing with are going to get paid no matter what. And, you know, their day-to-day lives will not change if they make every single parent in America angry. Yeah. So it's really, really hard to get the reform that you want and need in a system where you don't have those pain points or those leverage points. And so that those are the institutions that I really think are probably lost, and we probably need to find a way around them. Like in the K-12 context, it's universal school choice. In in the university context, it's cutting them off from federal benefits and money. And if not cutting them off, then attaching that money to a set of conditions that makes it difficult for wokes to operate in these universities. In the federal bureaucracy, it means we really need to be able to fire people. But in terms of woke capital, in some sense, it's the hardest because it's hardest for conservatives to wrap their mind around, like having big business like swing in on the cultural mm-hmm. left. But once we have made that mental leap, it's much easier to incentivize against it. There mm-hmm. are a lot of levers we can push. There are plenty of strategies and potential pain points that we can push, starting with the most small L liberal of them, which is just taking away extra benefits. Right, that have been doled out to companies, right, and making it painful for them to move out of a neutral stance and actually participate, or for an Elon Musk to come in and say, well, the first 10 people who refuse to do their jobs properly are going to be fired, as an example, and then the next, thousands of people are going to do their jobs more likely than not. So I actually think woke capital is pretty salvageable. I think some of these other institutions.
It's going to be a lot harder.
But again, each year, this gets worse, right? Yeah. So, and the solutions get correspondingly more radical and difficult to implement without, real like abandonment of liberal principles each year that this happens. And so, I'm very encouraged, but we need a bunch more Ron DeSantis's, right? And he's showing that political path is really popular, popular.
Yeah. Even and I think
in the middle.
And I think that's part of what the benefit of Elon Musk is as well, is that he's showing Silicon Valley that there's an appetite for that kind of leadership, and it can be done. And you can, it's yet to be determined whether he survives, actually really, truly reforming Twitter, meaning firing a bunch of people and getting away with it in the industry, which I think he totally can if he has the stomach for it. But that's part of what this is. And I'll just wrap up.
Moderation practices. Well, and opening up the moderation practices.
Hell yeah, exactly.
It's a one-two punch. And there's been no one, I think, yet in Silicon Valley or elsewhere, or Twitter alternatives or whatever, that have proven that can be successful. The cathedral has come after all of them.
Right.
So this is uphill for him.
Yes. And Rachel and I have both, we both wrote about that, I think, in the Federalist last week, that it's content moderation. It's the addictive business model of social media to begin with. And it's, of course, the algorithms as well and making those open source. So all of that important. And I just, the thing I'll toss to everyone for sort of closing thoughts on is the splintering of the economy in many different sectors. So for instance, like I see the power of what the Daily Wire is doing with movies. Not to say that Daily Wire is suddenly going to actually be a competitor of Viacom, CBS, and Discovery, Warner Bros, and whatever else, or Disney, Fox. I don't think that's the case, but it's to show and demonstrate to those old institutions, the legacy institutions, that there's an appetite for something different. But the problem is, if you're the New York Times and you're being showed by the intellectual dark web and sort of Barry Weiss and Substack that there is an appetite for that going forward, it doesn't matter as much to you anymore because your business model is just retaining the subscriptions of people, educated NPR class on the coast. And if that's your business model, your incentives to change are totally different. And your incentives to change are going to be totally different, too, as a more sort of post-truth generation becomes the top consumers. And so I think that's where the New York Times gets away with the Tucker Carlson profiles, because it just is punted into the echo chamber and bounces around and gets the positive feedback that something gets in an echo chamber. And then people in the other echo chamber hear about it and denounce it. And then most people just don't even hear about it because these legacy institutions don't have the power that they used to have, but they've also pared down their business models in some cases, not all cases, to the point where they don't need to have the power of mass media anymore. And I think we're going to see CNN test this, but I guess my point is, or my question for both of you is, I was thinking as we started taping this, I think we promised that our next podcast, we would come with policy solutions. And that's fine. Mine would be immediately, creating a pipeline outside of higher education on a state level. So Republican governors on the state level should be taking what Orrin Cass has written about at American Compass and implementing it immediately right now. Can't hesitate, do that. But I guess, you know, in that context where the culture is sort of splintered, meaning the business models are splintered, what do you think about the, like, so should the New York Times take an Elon Musk approach just from a business perspective?
No, I mean, I think the New York Times, I think you nailed it, Emily. The New York Times is not going to change because they're being rewarded within the business model that they have for doing what the question is, how much power does the New York Times continue to have over mainstream discourse by virtue of, you know, basically wearing the skin of a paper that once had that kind of mainstream power. And I think, again, that's in media, it's pretty encouraging. I think your piece with Ben Domenech about the new Contras, right? The total failure of CNN Plus in comparison to shows like Rising, right? I think it shows that mainstream power is quite brittle and is breaking. I think the worry is that it'll just be replaced by essentially content moderation. Because what allows those kinds of natural sort of market adjustments, you can have a New York Times, right? We've always had Jacobin, whatever, you know, like, but what is more worrying is the content moderation that sort of takes away. The internet giveth and taketh away, right? The internet giveth the power to make an end run around some of these sort of legacy media operations, but the internet taketh away if it's got a really strict content moderation policy that is completely biased and just recenters the same gatekeepers as and gives them right back that power to bound conversation, right? And in terms of policy solutions, I have like a list of ed policies, but I don't bore everybody with that. But there, especially with higher ed, there are solutions. There are policy levers that can be pushed to get what you want. The problem is the right just doesn't have the balls to push them. Or I should say, doesn't have the combination of balls and expertise to do it. Right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
There is a real problem with sort of, especially I think in the Trump administration, there were a lot of people who didn't really know what they were doing policy-wise. And then the people who, correspondingly, the people who knew how policy worked were so overwhelmingly opposed to the goals of the Trump administration that they were not useful in other ways. They were just sort of fifth columnists, right? In the and that needs to change. But you know, that's something that we can fix. We have to fix it quickly, but it's doable. To start to like unwind this credentialing, like sort of ideological treadmill in higher ed is doable. But the reason I'm cynical is not because it's not doable. It's totally doable. It's just that I haven't really seen a lot of evidence that Republicans are willing to, because there's a whole bunch of things. I would take anything, honestly. I would take, on Twitter, I proposed that we allow, now that there's all this debt forgiveness talk, like we do a income cap, 20K forgiveness for, like, let's say people whose projected earnings and excluding people with professional degrees and postgraduate degrees are, let's say, under the median. 20K in forgiveness, just... But make sure that comes out of university endowments. And I think that would be good in a whole host of reasons. First of all, it would remove the ability of the Democratic Party to hide behind the complete farce that this is for working class America. It's not. It's overwhelmingly forgiveness. 50% of the debt is people who have postgraduate degrees. Okay. Yeah. This is not and for every dollar that goes to the bottom quintile of the income spectrum in full debt forgiveness, $7 will go to the top quintile. Top quintile, not top half, top quintile of people. Top 20% of earners in America will get $7 in loan forgiveness for every $1 that goes to the bottom. This is wildly regressive. It's completely a payout to the professional managerial elite that make up the constituency of the Democratic Party. But we could do it on student loan debt. We could do it on Title IV funds that go to universities. We could do it through student loans themselves. We could attach riders. We could make do, you know, civil rights law investigations. There's literally thousands of ways that we could push on the university industry if the mindset change happens where it's these people are like these universities are pernicious influence on the country, period, full stop. We need to build our policy to hurt them.
Rachel,
there's a lot of ways to do it.
No, Rachel, now it's your turn to outdo Inez, and I will be grading each of your final responses on a scale of 1 to 10. Go.
I can never outdo Inez. That's just, I reject the premise.
The judges will be the determiner. Will determine that.
So I think like the issue with places to go back to sort of the original like framing of the question when we're talking about like places like the New York Times, the issue that I have with them is not necessarily what they write. It is that they still consider themselves the arbiter of the discourse. And, that they control what is being said, that they control the outlets to, and as a point about social media, on which it is being said. New York Times can write whatever the heck it wants, but it can no longer place itself, as king of the castle over what is said in the country. Because at the end of the day, what the New York Times is, to your point now, is it has a niche white liberal progressive audience. It is a niche publication. It does not speak for the country. Mm-hmm. And so if that is where we now live, this is why I harp so much about getting the social media stuff right and how we treat social media. Because if that is now how we disperse information in this country, which it is, I would argue, Google, Facebook, Twitter, all these things are how we disperse information, then we have to make those platforms open and available to all these type of publications that get this information out there. And, I've always said, from the beginning, I've been a fan of breaking these companies up. I don't see enthusiasm for the right for doing, on the right for doing that at all. No. So if we're not going to do that, then at the end of the day, I think the only policy solution you have to settle on is a common carriage type of situation where you have to, speaking of the FedEx truck, FedEx, a common carrier, right? The airlines, common carriers, you have to admit all comers. And then you take the algorithm and you destroy the targeted advertising model. You just destroy it so that content isn't being amplified or, pushed in a certain direction by monetary incentives, by woke incentives. You just let information flow. Right? Because that is the only way any of this works. And the right is not woken up to that, I don't think. The right's simply like, oh, we can still start our own publication. We can still start our own alternative. We can still do all these things. You can, but you will not. You will be cut off from the access to a mainstream audience unless you break the gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers in this instance are the app stores. They are, Google's search algorithm. They are, how Twitter filters information. They are, how Facebook moderates its content. They are all those things. And so until you have to get both right, because our traditional solutions are never going to work unless you literally burn down the gatekeepers. And I think, I'm also slightly skeptical that the right in totality has grasped how, I hate using the word radical because it suggests that, suddenly we've just come up with these ideas. I really think we've just been pushed to the point where this is how we have to address things. But you still have people like, Asa Hutchinson, who's, I think, the governor of Arkansas, right? Who is like, well, we should let parents trans their kids, right? It's like,
it's personal freedom.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a blessing of liberty.
It's like we've, these sort of rote slogans disconnected from any governing philosophy or any, philosophy of living. Which is what conservatism is in many cases, that still govern sort of the sort of high priests of our party. And that's, I think, the biggest problem that we face ultimately.
There was a long expose in BuzzFeed, alleged expose in BuzzFeed about Peter Thiel funding cultural causes. And that's increasingly much more what I'm interested in, because I think people are correct in their directional understanding that you can no longer trust your government, although your state government and your local government is going to be better on all of this. But the federal government, that's not to say it's a lost cause. You both are right that there are policy solutions that need to be pushed by experts, subject matter experts like yourselves, in these arenas. And I think there's total plausibility that as these incentives shift in different ways, those things can happen. But also, I think we all need to take more responsibility for our own lives and for our communities and for what we allow our children to watch, for who we send to public schools. And all of this, we didn't even talk about what I think is a public health emergency when it comes to the things that we have transferred all of our lives onto, our personal lives, our professional professional lives, our everything is now on these devices that are largely made like slot machines, to function like slot machines. So, you know, to an extent, we have to realize that our sort of our voting with our dollars and our voting with our own sort of lives is going to be perhaps the last real bastion of freedom and you know, virtue in the country. So that said, I give you guys both, I think maybe I was thinking in my head a 7.5, but I think I'm going to put that up. I think you both tied at an 8.13. So good job to
we'll endeavor to do better next time.
Yeah, there's room for improvement. That's all I'm saying. And we should make good on our promise to come with policies, like a list of potential policy solutions. I think people are very interested in that. And I know we have members
who
listen
to the group chat agenda.
Yes, yes.
Hey, I will just pump my own work. I have a piece out in the Federalist today about the disinformation board and how to solve that. You know how to solve it? Defund it. Republicans never do this.
It's really funny how many things, how many of these things can be solved by defund X. And it's equally funny how many libertarians are opposed to...
You're targeting
government defunding.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Rachel's like really well acquainted with the libertarian wing because her dog is constantly challenging her.
Hey, I was raised in libertarian movement, man.
Yeah, no, hey, a graduate of Grove City College, the bastion of conservatism. And
a Rand Paul alumni.
A Rand Paul, yeah, that's right, who has since become, again, an authoritarian. But here we are. I should say we should squeeze another one of these in before Rachel decides to relax on her extended vacation.
Yeah, yes, right, that's what we're calling it now.
That's what Buttigieg calls it.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. The when question I go on be, my Pete Buttigieg vacation.
Yeah. The question will be whether the infrastructure crumbles more in Rachel's absence or Pete Buttigieg's absence. Time will tell. Okay, guys. We will be back with another edition of this podcast featuring Rachel Bovard, who's senior tech columnist at The Federalist, also policy director at the Conservative Partnership Institute, and Inez Stepman, a senior policy analyst at Independent Women's Forum and also a senior contributor at The Federalist. Notice the word senior is in your title twice. Something to think about. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
The faint voice of reason.